I just want to welcome everyone to the first ever Two Beers with Steve podcast. The premise of the show is to create a forum where like-minded people can come together and exchange ideas about our economic future and all that it entails. The environment that I want to create is the same environment you might find around a table full of friends, very relaxed, easygoing. I realize that many of us have careers outside of Washington and Wall Street, and I want to cater to that crowd. Now, with that being said, I want to list my goals for this podcast. Ultimately, our exchanges on finance and policy, no matter how excellent they are, will have a zero net effect on what government actually does. My goal is to create a tipping point of awareness that we, the people, are no longer in control of our own government. I hope that can change by linking people together through the internet and being part of a grassroots movement. My expectation tonight is to link together the members of the Chris Martinson website, like ourselves, with the subscribers of Daniel Amadori and vice versa. So now I'd like to introduce our very first guest on Two Beers with Steve, Daniel Amadori. I came across Daniel on YouTube, where he goes by the screen name Vision Victory, and I saw him. He had a video where he predicted very accurately and very publicly that a market collapse would occur in the fall of 2008. His Vision Victory channel on YouTube has a little over 8,000 subscribers. His channel has been viewed over 637,000 times, and for those of you that are unfamiliar with these numbers, they are simply incredible. And considering that all these videos are just of Daniel sitting in a chair, staring into a camera and giving his ideas, make these numbers even more unbelievable. You know, so Daniel, I'd like to introduce you at this point and just kind of give us a quick background of yourself, just who you are, if you could.
Well, I'm like you, Steve. I'm just a regular guy, and you know, I started reading investment books, and I've been an entrepreneur since I was a child. You know, my mother has stories of me selling pencils in fifth grade, and fast forward to that to 18 years old, I buy my first house at 18 years old to flip, and I bought my first business at 18 years old, and it just snowballed and snowballed, and by the time I was 22, I had become a financially independent individual, and but I just remained a normal guy, even though my income dramatically increased over the years. You know, the year I made the most money, I often joke that I was driving a 1992 Toyota pickup that squeaked about 50 feet before a stop sign. So I have stayed true to my roots. And I'm just somebody who studies macroeconomics. I don't have a college degree, although I've taken college classes on economics, on real estate. What I have is a lot of experience. I've been on the front lines of business, and that is one of the things that has become my greatest asset. That is why I knew when the markets would go down, not because I had some special chart analysis of the stock market, but because I studied economics and I was on the front lines. I was knocking on the doors of the people who were in foreclosure, and I knew the thing was about to break.
Yeah. You know, there's about 10 questions I got to ask in there, but I'm going to go ahead and do like a quick introduction for everybody. I'll just introduce myself. You know, I'm Steve Patterson. I first came to the website of like Chris Martinson, the Crash Course series, and I'd say about October or so sometime. And actually, I'm a mortician in Southern Illinois, of all things. And I'll just turn it over to Sam and Joe and just kind of give quick introductions of themselves.
Okay, this is Sam. I'll take it at this point. The first thing I got to say is I'm almost embarrassed. At 18, I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. So when I hear someone like Dan, I go, oi. But I'm very impressed. I think that's really great, Dan, that you've done as well as you have. I admire people that are able to do what you do, and my compliments. I'm now 65. I was semi-retired until my consulting work fell off a cliff, so now I guess I'm fully retired. Oh, somebody else in there?
I think someone turned up their mic.
No? Okay. Anyway, I'm fully retired. I stumbled onto Chris Martinson's website via Andrew Tobias's website. I used to, well, still do, go to him on a daily basis to see what he has to say, and at some point last year, I think around July, he mentioned Chris Martinson's site, so I went over to see what that was about. And the crash course was in progress at that time, I think roughly around midpoint. or in the early teens, and like many people, I got hooked and stayed. And that's it.
Joe?
Hey, guys. This is Joe. I'm a computer programmer in Southern Connecticut. I found Chris Martinson's website, I think it was July or August last summer, off of Ron Paul's website. So here I am.
Okay. Daniel, you know, first thing I want to ask you is about, you know, I watched your video, and I think what was your first video, like March 18th or so?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, it's kind of funny to look back, you know, and you know, in January of this year and see your video where you were talking about a market collapse coming up. And I know that you had some experience in, like, the housing market. But, you know, like, I was in the steel industry. I knew the steel industry was going down. And I think most everybody kind of had a feeling, even back as far back as 2004, 2005, that the housing market couldn't continue like that. But there's always been that sense in the back of my mind, well, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. You know, so what made you just think that, well, this is it. There's going to be an event that's going to break the backbone of this this bubble.
Well, I was purchasing a lot of homes, and I was actually, you know, I had my wife, and she was not my wife at the time, but she was, gosh, I think she was probably 19 or 20, and we had purchased two investment properties for her, and she made about $1,000 a month. She was a waitress at Applebee's, and she was going to school full time. And it was probably at that moment when we closed escrow when I said, this thing is screwed, because we just purchased two homes with a person who makes $1,000 and who basically cannot support these homes. But I was financially supporting them, but I had too many loans on my credit. I had about 22 properties on my credit report. Nobody at that point wanted to give me a loan, so I was starting to use people who hadn't purchased homes yet. And it was kind of funny, but I would say that was kind of my aha moment where I said, you know what, I better start looking into this thing, because this thing is not sustainable. And of course, you know, as I progressed and started flipping properties in 2006, I noticed that it was getting harder for me to sell the properties, and properties were getting maxed out on people's incomes. People weren't able to afford where...
It seems like you're talking a lot of inside jargon of, you know, if you could, when you say maxed out on their income, meaning like as much as they've made in a year is what they're paying in mortgage payments a year?
Yeah, so the mortgage payments were consuming 50, 60, 70% of their monthly paycheck.
Okay. And what's typical, maybe like 30%?
Yeah, 28 to 32% has been the historical average.
And most of these people are just kind of looking for investments that they could flip to, or they were going to actually live in them?
A lot of people were going to live in them, especially in California. You had places in Phoenix and Las Vegas where they were just investors. But in California, they wanted to live in them, but they thought that they could make money because, of course, the houses were going up $10,000 a month.
Right.
So it was really a front lines attitude. Plus, I heavily read the data. I am just a data person. I'm nonstop. You know, I love information. So I was also reading the information, debt to income ratios as far as people getting loans, and I was also talking to a lot of the lenders that I had used, and they were letting me know that people were having trouble getting qualified, and that's when I sold everything. I sold everything in early 2007.
So you almost had like a full year before this thing actually started coming around.
Yeah, and a lot of people thought I was foolish for selling that early, because they were saying it was going to be a soft landing or was going to continue going up. But I'm very, very glad I did. And of course, I sold stocks as well in February of 2007. I sold anything I had in U.S. stocks. I completely exited out of the dollar, because even though I was front lines on the real estate, I was very well studied in the macroeconomic side as well, and knew that we were going to have a massive contraction in the housing market that would affect the entire economy.
And so who are you reading during this time frame, you know? Like, where do you get information from?
Well, I would say the most defining book for 2007 that I read was Peter Schiff's book, Crash Proof.
And that was 2007?
yeah, it came out actually in February 2007. One book that had helped me make a lot of macroeconomics decisions, because that's my goal, is to always invest in front of the trend, was The Next Great Bubble Boom by the Dent Brothers. I think it's actually by Harry Dent. And they had showed a lot of data as far as age and peak spending for people, and that was to occur around 2010. So I knew it was coming. I just didn't think it was going to come that soon. But I knew we were facing a lot of things as far, and you guys are all familiar with Chris Madison's video from what I'm getting. So in the Next Great Bubble Boom with Harry Dent, he discusses everything Chris Madison did. I think his book came out in 1999 or 2000, maybe even the early 2000s. But I knew that was coming, and when I saw the housing market starting to crack, I knew that it was probably not going to make it to 2010 or 11, and it was going to start much earlier.
How old are you, Daniel?
I'm 28.
28. You know, it's like I'm 33, and I've pretty kept a pretty close tabs on the economy ever since maybe like more than 10 years or so. And during that time frame, I've seen some pretty pretty severe, not even severe, but, you know, I've seen some retractions, but we always seem to come back. And then you look back in history, you know, looking past 30 years, you know, it always came back. And so no matter – I always had this mentality that, like, yeah, I know it's real bad right now, but – and even today I think, well, you know, I know it's real bad right now, but I think it could come back. You know, I mean, you must have a different way of looking down the road than I do. Are you just – do you see what I'm getting at? Is it your vision is a little bit different than mine, because I think I'm basing a lot of mine on my previous past, and mm-hmm. in the past it's always seemed to work out somehow. They found some way. They used some sort of stimulus and that got us through another 3 or 4 years.
It's so interesting that you say that, because my mentor taught me that you always wanted to have young investors around you, because they had the pulse of the market and they had fresh perspective. And a lot of times you have people like Bob Brinker who are known for market timing, but they totally got this one wrong because their experience worked against them. Their life experience worked against them. So it's possible that because your life experiences are that we always bounce back, that they actually you had these preconceived perceptions of our economy that I didn't. All I knew was the math. I didn't have a life experience to compare a previous recession. I had the 2000 recession in my adult life, or 2001 or whatever, but I didn't really have, I've never been through hard times. So I was purely looking at the numbers. I didn't have anything to compare this to.
Right. And you know, it's kind of weird about the fact that you pulled out in 2007. Somebody's working some issues out, but you pulled out in 2007. So there was a long period of time where everybody else was right, and you had an incentive to be in the market, but yet you had the vision not to be. You know, that's the problem I see with Wall Street. Is like everybody seemed to know that things were going to go sour, but there was an incentive for them to keep on going because they kept getting paid, and then everybody had the feeling that when things get real bad, I'll pull out at the perfect time.
Yeah, and plus, Wall Street and the entire country have been in a bull market since 1982. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for people to even fathom the idea of a bear market. If you look at even the 1987 stock market crash, within 3 months we were already positive again on the Dow Jones. So all the financial planners, no one has really been through a severe recession in the last 30 plus years, you know, since the late 70s. And certainly they have not seen a major decline in stocks. Stocks have continuously bounced back, and they've almost just gone straight up. If you look at a 80-year chart of the Dow from 1982 to basically 2008, it went straight up.
Okay. What got you to start vlogging? I mean, you figured this out and you spent some time, and then you got on YouTube. I mean, what first got you started talking to people?
It's my family. I had tried to tell my family from basically early 2007 all the way, you know, throughout Bear Stearns collapsing through the summer of 2007 when we saw the market first start to go down. I think that's when the Dow Jones hit its all-time high for the first time. And I had pleaded with my family. I had actually told them to buy gold back in 05, 04 when I was buying it. But I pleaded with them to get out, to start protecting yourself, start buying rice and food and preparing. And no one listened to me, no one. They all ignored me. So I was on the internet and I came across a video by a person who has a channel. It's called Man of Truth.
Uh-huh.
And I watched his channel and I noticed he kept mixing his Mormon religion with the economic videos. And I thought that was a disservice to the thousands of people that need to be warned because he was turning people off. So if you notice in my videos, even though I'm a man of faith, you will not see me wear my faith on my sleeve because my goal with my videos was to warn as many people and not to put stumbling blocks in front of them. That's why you also see, even though I do believe in an Amero currency, I do believe in global elitists that are pulling a lot of strings here, I'll never mention that because my goal is to reach out to the common man and get him prepared. I don't have time to teach everybody everything. So, you know, my goal is that my videos will help them get out of the river. You know, if they want to go and go on a journey like you guys have and learn all about economics, that's fine. But my goal is to pull them out of the river.
Have you noticed like a change in the type of people that are showing up at your YouTube channel now that things have kind of turned for the worse? I mean, ever since maybe like September, because you've been doing this since March. So did some really smart people started showing up around September, October?
Well,
a little more mainstream folks.
Yes, a lot more mainstream folks. You know, you'll get questions, of course. You know, I feel like a lot of times I have to keep repeating myself, but what people on the outside aren't seeing is, you know, I'll get anywhere from 400 to 600 private messages a day that I don't even scratch the surface of answering all of them.
Uh-huh.
But they seem to be the same questions, and they just grow and grow and grow. And it's about, should I still sell my U.S. stocks?
You're right, yeah, yeah.
Now, of course, people who've seen my videos know the answer.
Right.
So that tells me that I've got a lot of new people flooding into the channel.
Right, yeah. Because I mean that's even like a point that like when we start the Skype forum is everybody asks every week we ask about that same question. We sit around and we talk about the same question, and I mean I'm gone, I'm out because I fear it enough. I can see 3-4 months in the future, and it ain't gonna we're not gonna be in positive territory in the next 3 or 4 months, and I don't think this is, I'm not a doomsdayer, but I don't see a good scenario ending up on the in a few years. So you know, based on that, though, how do you see this thing playing out?
Well, that's a very hard question. I'm sure you guys.
Yeah.
You know, the further you go out, the easier it's actually to it's easy to say that the country is insolvent, and you know we're going to face a major currency crisis within 10 years. To say what's going to happen the next year and a half is much harder, and certainly post economic collapse, where we go from there is even more speculative. But where I see us for 2009 and 2010. I think by 2009, you're going to see a lot of the extended unemployment benefits start to be cut off. And also, people who, the 2 million people who have been laid off in the last 3 months and the millions before them are going to start to get increasingly discouraged. And it's going to start to reach a boiling point by this summer. I think crime is going to increase significantly by the end of the summer and by the early fall. By November or December, I think you're going to see a lot of stories of shootings and theft, especially as we get closer into the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
I think the market is going to stay in a trading range from now until the summer, possibly moving down late June, early July. But our next major move, Dow Jones 4000, will be within the end of September to October.
Of
2009.
And then interest rates are moving.
I'd say interest rates are going to stay at zero.
I'm just saying about
sell in May, go away.
Yeah.
But then go away forever, you know, not don't come back after October earnings.
Exactly.
I was going to say that I know that the Fed's going to keep their interest rates pegged at zero, and the only way they can fight this is to just keep pumping more money into the system. But what I was talking about was, you know, like your 30-year treasuries, you know, your 10-year treasuries. You know, just – I mean they've got to go up. I mean they're paying 3.25. So that means there's that means that like it's a pretty safe bet on U.S. treasuries. And this is more
technical question. You mean betting against them?
Oh, yeah. That's what I think. I think you can bet against them. And you know – I should say this though. It's like I'm not interested in making money. I'm interested in protecting what I have. And so
I personally don't short treasuries. I mean, I did a lot of shorts in 2007, but I don't short really anything anymore. But I specifically don't short treasuries because buying gold and silver is essentially doing the same thing. And instead of shorting the treasuries and having your profits in electronic dollars stuck in the system. If you have gold and silver, you're essentially shorting treasuries and you have this physical money in your hand.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people are pushing shorting treasuries, but I think it's much better move to hold gold, especially because if you remember after 9/11, they closed the stock market for about a week. And in other countries where they've had economic meltdowns, I think in Russia, they closed the stock market down for like 8 months. So you're much better. They're going to close the stock market, and it's probably going to get closed this year, if not sometime in 2010. But that thing's going to be closed, and I don't know how long it's going to be closed, but you're not going to be able to get your money out of Ameritrade. So I don't trust any profits trapped in dollars, especially if I don't like shorting the currency and getting profit in that same currency I'm shorting.
Yeah. Okay. So you're taking physical gold. You're taking physical gold delivery.
Absolutely.
And I imagine you're not putting in a safe deposit box down at Citibank.
No. I don't trust the safe deposit box in the United States. I do hold some metal in my gold money account. That's what James Turk – it's not even his company. It's actually – he's just on the – I think he's the CEO. But it's a very reputable company. And I hold some gold and silver in a Swiss bank – in a Swiss vault.
Okay. And you don't have to answer this question if you want to, but you know, what do you consider like a safe place to hide like your physical gold? Because I mean, you know, that's a question that's been tossed around here quite a bit. I mean, I live in a small town in the middle of nowhere. I feel pretty comfortable with where I have it placed. Yourself? You even feel comfortable?
I think you should get extremely creative.
Okay.
I think you should drywall it in, whatever you have to do.
Okay.
But I can tell you personally, I can't tell you my hiding spot, obviously, but I can tell you that where my main bulk is, it would take me days to extract it. It would be absolutely inconvenient for even myself to get it out, and that's where I feel safe.
Okay.
Hey, Dan?
Yes?
Do you see gold moving in any particular direction during all of this, or do you see it just wallowing around where it is right now and then suddenly skyrocketing when the rest of this stuff hits?
I think it's just going to wallow around. And I don't, unfortunately, I thought gold would have a major move in 2009, but as the year progresses, I think gold will not have a major move until 2010.
Yeah. Oh. You know, I mean, I don't know what you want to say about this, but there's an enormous amount of like, you know, derivative pressure on gold to keep it down. I mean, that's just part. If you go to the, you know, the central bank, or I don't know where it's at, but their website posts just how you can peg your currency, and part of that is manipulating the gold in accordance with your currency. So do you think maybe that's in play here? I mean, that might be another technical question, but the fact that it's being derivatively pressured to be down in the $800-$900 range. They don't want to see it go to over $1,000 in the $1,100 range.
Absolutely. And if you notice, they're also stripping the middle class of their physical gold. Not only is there manipulation in the futures markets, but you've got Super Bowl commercials with companies buying people's gold. You've got gold parties going around in the country right now. I don't know if you've seen the news stories, but where you get together and Cash for Gold shows up to your house and they're buying all your gold up. So you have the wealthy buying and hoarding the gold right now, as well as central banks suppressing the price. They've done that for decades now. It's really noticeable in the silver market. I think silver is going on in backwardation for like 45 days now. So
I'm not familiar with backwardation, but that means the futures price is actually lower than the spot price. Is that correct?
It basically means they're paying a premium to have it delivered today.
Okay, can you explain? I'm not really familiar with that.
A futures contract 3 months out should be just, you know, it's typically no one's getting anything delivered. So, you know, I think silver to buy a futures contract is 1,000 ounces. So no one's getting delivered. It's less than 1%. But when you have demand for delivery, you'll see like basically like you'll see April's contract is worth more than June's contract.
Yeah, okay. So there's somewhere in the future there's going to be – the price is actually inverting.
Yeah, so people want the physical metal. They don't even the big investors don't trust the futures markets anymore. And you know the COMEX, you know I don't know all the details because you know it's hard to grasp you know get your whole head around the thing because there's so many different players. But I was reading a story the other day that they were talking about gold almost defaulted. I don't know if any of you guys saw
GLD.
That.
GLD. The GLD?
The gold actual gold futures contract was on the verge of so many people were demanding delivery that it was ready to default, and the ECB came in and bailed it out.
Out of their reserves.
I think I heard that.
So
January, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Dan.
I only saw like a paragraph and a half in the story, but so they didn't really go into it in depth. I don't recall anybody else really talking about it, but I'd be interested in learning more about that. But anyway, the COMEX, you know, is absolutely manipulated. In fact, there's a group called GATA. Have you guys heard of GATA?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go to GATA.org, they,
how do you spell that?
Anytime there's manipulation, in the gold markets, they've got a story. They're on the front lines of that.
And how do you spell that?
GATA.org.
Okay.
Hey, Daniel, if you want to answer this question, what percentage of your assets are in gold and silver, or what would you recommend to the average person?
Well, it's hard because everybody's at a different stage, but I can tell you where I was last year, and I'll tell you where I am today. Last year, I was 30% in the metals. I was probably 20% gold, 10% silver, and then I was in foreign stocks, commodities, utilities, and some small, you know, like 5% bear funds. Today, as it stands, I have been extremely aggressive in my silver purchases, and I've even sold some gold to buy more silver. And right now, I'm probably about 80% silver, 10% gold, and 10% stocks.
Why the silver?
I think silver is not the investment opportunity of a lifetime, but it's the investment opportunity of human history. Silver is the safest place for us. Silver not only is a great investment for the long term, if you see my YouTube video, I'd recommend you watching my silver video, but I just, as we've progressed into this meltdown, I trust gold and silver more and more, and not to say I didn't ever not trust them, but I always trusted the stock market. I always trusted foreign exchanges. And as this thing progresses, I'm starting to be very concerned for any assets in the electronic world, any assets held on some foreign exchange in Australia. I am starting to be very concerned for any of these assets, any asset held in any currency. You know, this time last year, I was confident that the United States was going down and that foreign currencies would do okay against the dollar. I'm now concerned about a global fiat currency crisis. So I'm And certainly silver has more room to run than gold.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now they're like, I don't know, 65 to 1, but they've always been about 15 to 1. That's 15 ounces of silver to purchase 1 ounce of gold.
So, where's silver's at right spots right now? About 13?
I think it's like 1287.
1287. Okay. All right. Anybody else have any questions? You know, one thing, it's like we talk about all this stuff and it just seems so immensely complex. You know, I mean, when you're talking gold, silver, interest rates, and the Fed's manipulating the market, it's so immensely complex. I just have lost faith in the system even if they presented a really good program, they don't know the correlations, what it's going to, you know, I'm talking about the Treasury here, I'm talking about the Fed here, that they'll even be able to really understand what kind of side effects, you know, this might have in other different markets. You know, I mean, I imagine you've lost complete faith in the system. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't know where else I was going to go with that, but anybody else have any questions for Dan?
Really, really quick, I just want to say, if you guys have not gotten a chance to view a video that I made, it's called Silver, Gold's Little Big Brother. I would definitely recommend you seeing it. It's got a lot of information. It took me a lot of time to gather information for that video. And I guarantee it will open your eyes to the investment of silver if you haven't gotten a chance to see it.
Well, I say it one more time. Silver?
It's called Silver, Gold's Little Big Brother.
Okay.
And it's on YouTube. It should be on my front page.
Sure.
Yeah. And I imagine, you know, like here's a question I have for you, and just to switch gears a little bit, is that, you know, I have people ask me all the time, you know, like expecting a really simple answer because, you know, they know that I, you know, I actually give speeches and stuff like that. I do like presentations, I should say, about the economy and that sort of thing. And everybody wants a really quick answer on what happened to the economy. And I've learned through bad experiences that the best way to answer this is not to answer this at all. And so, I mean, you're someone who knows a lot about the economy, and you push this. You have these videos, and people probably in your personal life know that you do this. So, do you answer this question, or do you bother with it?
I do. I answer it every time.
And you'll take the time to move them through all the – I mean, it's so difficult because a lot of times when they want to know one specific part of the economy, I start explaining it and they're not – and they haven't – I have to qualify them on what I'm about to talk about. And it becomes very complex and they throw up their hands. When in fact, to me, it seems very easy, but it's because I understand the language. I understand a lot about it. But how do you get past that?
Well, in short, it's just like you said, you qualify people. If it's, you know, somebody who's just trapped inside the matrix, I'll just tell them, look, we borrow too much. We borrow to consume. It was unsustainable. I'll talk about the statistics for, you know, Americans had a savings rate of 10% all the way to 1985. It went to negative last year. So I might just give them a short answer. If it's somebody like you, somebody who knows about economics, I may go a little further. I may start talking about the currency crisis, the currency itself. I will rarely go into the Federal Reserve because that is too hard to explain.
Yeah.
And it is, it looks like I'm a conspiracy nut.
Right.
So if I was to tell my father-in-law, who's a doctor, about the Federal Reserve not being a part of the government, I will lose my credibility with
right,
it.
Yeah.
And credibility is huge, especially with the people you talk to every day.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to lose that credibility because you want to help them. You don't want to be a stumbling block for them. And, you know, I'll never forget my wife and I sitting at the kitchen table having dinner with the family. And I was talking about the economy collapsing. This was probably in 07. And then my wife jumped out and said, yeah, and they're going to switch to a currency called the Amero. And I think I just looked at her and I was like, wow, you know, we will never, they'll never listen to us now because you just mentioned the Amero.
Right. Yeah.
They'll never listen to us. So I will never, I stay clear from any conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
even though a lot of the conspiracy theories are true, especially the Federal Reserve's not a conspiracy theory, but everybody thinks it is because it says Federal Reserve.
Yeah, yep, federal.
And then, of course, you know, if I have somebody who really wants to have an in-depth conversation, you know, I'll steer them all the way to Woodrow Wilson, where Woodrow Wilson was the defining moment for the United States. We had the IRS under Woodrow Wilson. We had the Federal Reserve under Woodrow Wilson. We had World War I. And a lot of people don't realize that Europe had a lot of wars. In fact, that Europe had major wars where France invaded Germany in the late 1800s. And the United States never got involved. And if you look at where our turning point was, where we went from republic to entering into our empire phase, it was all goes back to World War I, where we set a precedent where we were going to get involved in a foreign war. And that is something our founding fathers really didn't want us to get into. And of course, you know, World War I, you can flip a coin on whose side we were going to join. What difference does it make whether we join Germany's side or England's side? It was a total flip of a coin. And certainly the United States got itself into World War. I don't want to mix the wars, but I believe World War I was when we had a ship.
Lusitania? The Lusitania.
Yes, the Lusitania. And that could have been avoided. And we were trading with we were helping them with supplies on the British side. And it's the same thing for World War II. We had entered the war long before 1941 by cutting off oil supplies to the Japanese. So the United States has slowly become an empire, and now we're in a situation where we don't even declare war when we go to war.
Yeah.
And that precedent was set by Harry Truman. So, you know, if people really want to go, where did this start? The seed was planted in 1913.
Yeah. You know, I'll bring it back a little bit. You know, you're talking about like the conspiracy theory and that sort of thing. And these guys have heard me talk about this before, but I think what we're talking about is, and you said before that you're a religious person, that this idea that we are pitching is very faith-based. Okay, and what I mean by that is that, like, and you don't try to push your religion on anybody, because they turn you off. You know, they'll switch the channel. They don't listen to you anymore. And I think that's kind of the same way with what we're talking about here. And even myself, you know, it's like I've got to have, like just like in a religion, you know, there's a, you know, you've never met God, you've never seen him, but you have to have faith in the existence of a God. Okay, because you have based on your previous history, there's never been a God, but you're saying there's a God in the future. You know, you'll meet up in heaven. Okay, so this is the kind of the same thing with what you're talking about. What we're thinking about is that based on our previous history, and I'm 33 years old, on going back that far, and I have to have faith that there's going to be a disconnect between my past and my future. So there's got to be some – it's a faith jump. So I think I really try to toe that line very, very, very carefully, because you don't want to turn people off. You know, you want to avoid conspiracy theories, and I want to avoid conspiracy theories, doom and gloom, negative stock market, the Dow 4000 scenario, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when it comes to religion. I am a follower of Christ. I'm a Christian, but nothing is more annoying to me then when I flip on the TV and I hear a preacher telling us that it's the end of the world tomorrow. Because yeah. I've seen that stuff since I was a kid. And actually, right. If you study the scriptures, they've been saying that since Jesus left day one. They've been waiting for the second coming. And I'm not saying it's not going to happen this year or 10 years or 30 years from now. But I'm saying it's a disservice to constantly saying that. Oh, you know, it's almost like an arrogance. Because America is falling, this must be the end.
Mm-hmm.
Empires have come and gone for over 2,000 years since Christ left. The United States is just another empire.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too far off topic here, but, you know, one thing is, like, the, I don't know if you're following Joel Osteen, but there was a switch there from that whole doom and gloom to a very – it was called a prosperity preacher, and it lasted through the 2000 – maybe I don't know how long this really lasted, but I really started to pick up on it around 2003 to about 2007. You know, what are the Joel Osteens saying now about, you know, owning those two cars and having that big house? And, you know, and I don't want to get too far off topic, but maybe if you want to answer that real quick.
Well, I think the Prosperity Church is going to collapse. I think it's already in a collapse, and nothing could make me happier because I think it's disgusting what they've done to the faith.
Okay. Well, I could continue and question you all night. Is there anything you want to maybe like that you brought up on videos that you thought were like, you know, that were very important issues that you brought up that kind of blew over a little bit? Or is it, you know, maybe like the most recent one was the G20 one. Okay, let's talk about the G20 a little bit. You know, what do you think, you know, because in my opinion, it's, you know, I don't fully understand the SDRs because I haven't looked into it. I've been pretty busy. But, you know, there's always this push to centralize power. But if you look at, let's say you're running a business, it's from a business perspective, to having one currency is actually, you know, that you don't have all those transactional costs. I mean, there are definitely positive benefits to it, you know, and there's some downsides to it I'm also a conspiracy theorist, but I don't like the idea any better. But, you know, from a business perspective, this is actually a good thing, being a trade across from China to the U.S. without having to incur transaction costs. It's actually a positive thing. Or the fact that, you know, any other country in the world has got to purchase dollars just so they can purchase oil, cost them, there's a tax on that.
Yeah, it sucks because national sovereignty is what keeps us free people. And this gets into my faith again, but in my faith, I of course do not want to see a one world government, but you're right. From the humanist perspective, a one world currency is a smart idea. A one world government is an even smarter idea because you have to end the squabbling amongst nations to progress as a human species. You know, you look at the Rockefellers and the Bilderbergs and these people, they're not thinking about God or individual human rights. They're thinking about, you know, how are we going to get colonies on planets and other universes? And they need to end the squabbling. So I think certainly from the humanist perspective, yeah, you want to get to one world currency, one world government as fast as you can, especially if you're an elitist who believes in other civilizations out there somewhere else besides the human species, because they want to get mobilized as fast as possible,
right.
And you know, meet these people or at least be prepared. So from the humanist perspective, yeah, that's, of course, it's a no-brainer. You want to end the squabbling, but
right. So you're not,
the squabbling is what keeps us free.
And then the slavery bit, like the fact that they want to. I'm not in a new world order at all, but and there's always that pitch what turns me off immediately is they want to turn us all into slaves. What do you think about that?
Any
truth to that, or is it just it falls along the lines of it makes good business sense to make a new world order, a one world government?
I think as far as being slaves, I don't think anybody's going to be slaves is what we think of a slave, but as far as being videotaped every second of the day when you go outside and being tracked, yeah, if you consider that slavery, then I guess you'd be a slave. But certainly one of the principles, and we're getting to the outer limits here now, but one of the principles of the New World Order is to reduce the population and not let it get larger than 500 million. So, you know, then you start to have to think about how are they going to get there?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with 8 billion people, there's going to be a lot of people that need to get cleared out.
Yeah.
I don't know. What is your opinion on the New World Order? And as far as, do you think we're looking at a one world currency in the next 10, 20 years?
Yes. Yeah. I think it makes for transactional costs, you know, because there's so much trading that goes on. You know, when you have, you know, like a product that you purchase, like a vehicle that's probably been in some form or fashion in about, you know, maybe 15 different countries, and it comes together at once, there's an enormous tax on that vehicle by the time you roll out of it, just in transactional costs. So I think that makes the sense part of it, you know. But then you know, what doesn't make sense is that who's going to control the amount of currency that goes into circulation? And then what exactly is going to back this up? Are they going to have like a gold standard, maybe a basket of currencies to represent that special drawing rights? I mean, where is it going to be decided the value of this? Because in the fiat currency, it's just based on confidence and in trust that it can be repaid who's going to be drawing? The IMF is the one that's going to be backing it up. Okay, so what products, what commodities does the IMF own? They don't own anything. I mean, they just have a contract with all these countries. So that's where it falls apart.
Yeah. Hey guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but when all the currencies were under a gold standard, wasn't everything fixed 1-to-1? All the currencies fixed to each other 1-to-1?
No, because they were never all backed by gold. Just the dollar was.
Oh, just the dollar. Oh, okay. I thought they all were.
No, and they were all pegged to the dollar. And the Swiss franc was the only other currency that had some gold backing for a short time.
Okay.
That's a good question too. Is I've also got my hang-ups about the gold standard too. I mean, do you want to see the dollar return to a gold standard? Is the Amero a good idea, Daniel?
I think the best thing to do now is to back the dollar to rebuild, and I'm talking it from an American standpoint, to rebuild America. To back the dollar with a basket of commodities, because the United States is rich in commodities. Yes. We have oil, we have natural gas, we have coal, we have food. I think gold would be difficult. I think gold should be in the basket, but I think we should back it with a basket of currencies.
Right. Yeah, that's probably the best answer I've heard in a long time for that question, because a lot of people want to go back to gold standard. Well, a gold standard is very stringent. You know, it doesn't – you know, what it is, it is what it is. And let's say you actually have a growth phase, you know, where you become more efficient. So there's this chasing for gold, you know, and they did during the Industrial Revolution. It's like there was a monumental shift in the value of our country. So people had a hard time getting a hold of money because it was backed by – gold, which was hard to find because we were adding so much value. So if we, you know, if you actually add real value, then you should actually add more currency. There needs to be more. You know, it's just like a bigger engine needs more oil.
Yeah, I think in order to back it by gold, they would have to nationalize every mining company.
Yeah.
Too, because they would have to be getting gold right out of the mines. They wouldn't have time to purchase it on the open market. They would just simply have to. Newmont Mining and stuff would have to just become United States government owned. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah, and when you look at that Zimbabwe for bread, or was that gold for bread in Zimbabwe, which I actually pulled off of your website there. You know, when I watched that video, is they have no resources to go to. You know, they were digging deeper and deeper into the ground because that was the only value they could find in their economy. It's a sad situation because they can't grow their own food. You know.
Yeah, and it was also interesting that, you know, when you're in the midst of the storm, when you're in the eye of it, everything actually becomes worth even more. So look, a gram for gold in Zimbabwe is equal to one loaf of bread, but a gram of gold in the United States can get you about, what's a gram of gold worth? About $50? So you're looking at, you're looking at
25-1.
15, 20, 30, 40 loaves of bread. But in Zimbabwe, where they were in the eye of the storm, it was only worth one.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. They're paying $50
for a loaf of bread. So bread had gone up, too.
Yeah, bread had gone up. Yeah, they're paying for more. You know, and I should really have a friend of mine. His name is Marco. He lived in Serbia during the collapse of their economy, and the only thing they could transfer out of their country that was of value anymore because they totally abandoned the dinar for the German mark was the only thing that held its value were actually things that you own, like a vehicle would actually hold real value, and then gold, you know, precious metals, that sort of thing. You could really store your value in the gold, because if one currency collapses, gold is priced in another currency.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, you touched on it briefly before, Daniel. What are your thoughts on real estate? I was looking at that Case-Shiller index chart, and I'm actually looking to sell my place to get into something where I could, you know, community-based, you know, grow my own food. But I was just curious what your thoughts are on real estate for the next year or two.
Well, I think real estate has a long ways to go. If you look at historical averages to incomes, historically they're about three times an average house is three times the average income. So in Southern California, where in LA County, where the average income is about 55 grand, homes should be somewhere around $150,000 to $200,000. But right now they're still, I don't think there's any homes in LA County for 200,000. They're still in the threes, they're still in the fours. So they still have a long ways to pull back to be at that historical long-term average. I also think in any bubble, it usually overshoots on the way down. So we should go down even more than we need to. Factor in unemployment and option arms and all this stuff, real estate's going to be a mess for the next 12 months, next 24, 36 months, actually, if you look at all the resets. And this doesn't even go into the currency crisis and the other factors. So I wouldn't touch real estate right now. I think when the dust settles, you'll be able to purchase a nice piece of property for 50 to 100 ounces of silver with a home on it, probably 200 ounces tops.
Okay. Hopefully I can sell then.
My last thing I want to talk about, because we're just getting towards the end here, is, I mean, we've talked about situations where things could take a turn for the worst. And that's one thing, like, you know, I've spent enough time getting information about how bad the market is, how this is going bad, how this is going bad. And there comes a point in time where you just say, you know what, I get it. Okay. Now, how can I prepare for a different future? What are my preparations? So what are you doing to prepare yourself for a collapse?
Well, it started with just preparing for the initial collapse, for when basic food services, grocery stores, and possible utility disruptions may occur. So that starts off by buying a lot of rice, buying a lot of beans and emergency bars. I have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of calories in these emergency bars available. You know, it starts with major, major food preparation. And I tell people, when you're preparing for food, don't think in pounds, think in tons. So I literally have tons of food, no exaggeration. And I also don't plan on just feeding my wife and I. I hope to help the community. I hope to be one of those sources where we can help feed people in the community, as well as I begin making relationships in my own community with people who not only grow food, have goats, but fix cars. I mean, whatever. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I want to know everybody's skill in the community, because mm-hmm. we're going to be able to barter and help each other out. One of the things, you know, when you get more extreme, once you've got your food and your water and your flashlights and your tent and your emergency alternative escape routes, where you're going to go if your area is just unsafe. Once you get to that point, then you actually want to start living the lifestyle. And that's actually where I am. That's what I'm entering right now. And I've actually just started a new YouTube channel called Victory Independence. And that channel is going to take people into the transition for the long term, because it's not always going to be, you know, hiding in your closet with a shotgun eating beef jerky. You know, eventually is going to be a new world. But that new world is going to have less purchasing power for Americans. The world we live in now is going away forever. So you want to learn how to start eating cheaper foods and learn more recipes, how to cook. Now, this is something I've done. I've moved to a rural area. So I have trouble. I love animals. I buy chickens, they become my pets. I buy goats, they become part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So where I need to take myself, and I'm going to in the next 3 months, is learning how to kill a chicken and then gut it and clean it and eat it. Learning how to kill a goat and gut it, kill it, and eat it. And that's going to be hard for me probably the first time, because I love animals, but it's going to have to become part of my lifestyle. See, Americans, they think it's disgusting to kill an animal and then eat it, or kill a rabbit or something, because we're used to, you know, hamburgers and chicken. That's it. But we buy it from the store.
Uh-huh.
But I'm transitioning my life right now into learning how to really become an independent person. And so that's kind of what I'm doing to prepare right now. I always use this sense when I buy a business or I buy a house, I always tell everybody, when the deal closes, I want to hit the ground running. And so it's almost kind of like that with my preparation. I want to transition into the lifestyle today. Mm-hmm. That way, there is no transition for me. I'm already there.
Okay, here's another question for you too, because this has come up before with people, and especially on the Chris Martinson website, is about weapons, about guns, about protecting themselves in some form or fashion. And now you live in a rural community. Do you feel the need to have a weapon out there?
I do. I always feel the need to have a weapon. Now, this kind of goes on a personal side, so everybody's got to make their decision.
Yeah.
I am a nonviolent person, so I don't really plan on shooting people, and I'm certainly not going to fight against the government because I know they'll just blow me up. There's no chance. I'm not going to go Rambo. There's no chance.
Right.
But so I don't own any handguns, and that's a personal decision because handguns are made to shoot people. I own shotguns. Because I can use them for hunting purposes, and I can use them for home protection. Now, no doubt, if there's a mob at my house, or somebody's attacking me, or my wife, or my soon-to-be child, I'm going to shoot that person, and I'm going to shoot to kill.
Mm-hmm.
But my goal is not to be out snipering, the New World Order, and
right.
It's certainly not. I have no plans of running around with a gun trying to hurt people. My goal is to go in lockdown mode in the initial civil unrest period and then, have the weapons for hunting. But yeah, I hope it never comes to that, but I really don't want to shoot a person. I will if they threaten my family's life, but I really hope it doesn't come to that.
You know, it's an interesting point of me talking about chickens and, I live in a small community, so there's people that do that sort of thing, So and they you can purchase it directly from them. And we had a gentleman, because I'm kind of now in that phase where I'm feeling out, because I don't have all the skills and knowledge to make it through this alone. And we've had other people on this web that have come to this forum before who have said, we moved out to the sticks, but we're out there by ourselves. We really don't understand that you really need a community to make this happen. You need to know the people around you. And everybody needs to help each other out. That's the only way you can make it through. And so I'm reaching out to people who have the skills and the knowledge. And so me and my wife purchased some eggs from a local guy. And when they showed up, they don't look like the store-bought eggs. They were brown eggs, but they had brown spots all over them. And we kind of looked at them like, are these even safe? And then my wife made the mention, this is more natural than what something you'd find on any store shelf at Walmart or IGA or any other, grocery store. So this is what people lived on for thousands of years. So it's just kind of you have to have a switch over in your mind. Have you figured that? Have you seen that happen, Daniel? Like you almost have, you've been programmed for so long, you have to break free of certain things.
It's so true. When my chickens first started laying eggs, I just had the hardest time. They just sit there, and I just collected them because I just couldn't eat them. It was like it was different, and it was like that originally when we started milking the goat, and it was just like this mindset of like. I just felt like throwing up because I was like gagging. I was like, I just can't drink it. But mm-hmm. here it is. It's just milk.
Right.
It just didn't get pumped out by a milk company.
Mm-hmm.
It's just milk.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it is. It's a mindset. I mean, you got people in China eating the heads off of chickens. An American, the chickens, it's got breasts and thighs and legs. That's it. But there's a lot more meat on that chicken to eat.
Yeah. Well, I want to really give you a big, big thanks for coming and visiting with us. We've reached just over the hour mark here, as far as I can see. And, can you tell people where, to get a hold of you?
Well, hey, the best way to get a hold of me is to go to the Vision Victory website. I check all the personal messages. I don't get back to all of them. Like I said, I get hundreds a day, but every single message gets opened. The best chance of getting a reply is to keep it short and simple.
Okay. All right. Anybody got any last questions for Daniel?
I have a quick question for Daniel. What part of the country are you physically in?
I'm in Southern California, Sam.
Southern California. Okay. Can you narrow it down to a county?
Yeah, I'm in San Bernardino County. It's a county just east of LA County.
Oh, okay.
It's largest county in landmass, but I'm really close to LA County. So I would say I'm on the west side of San Bernardino County. you know, because this is going to get posted on the web eventually. I'm going to keep it private, but, you know, I don't mind telling people where I live, but, you know, for obvious reasons, I do keep my identity and stuff private as far as where I live,
yeah,
because of, you know, where we all believe we're going,
right,
where we know we're going. And
yeah,
I just don't want to advertise where the guy with gold and silver lives, you know?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. No, we understand completely. We try to make an effort on the Chris Martinson website, especially in the beginning. We all are somewhat vague and
right,
live in the East Coast or the West Coast, and people don't narrow it down too often until we get comfortable with each other, and then we begin to be a little more revealing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I was going to ask something else, but now it's.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to end this podcast right now, and I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and I'm hopefully going to do this once a week, and then we can just continue on discussing here. So, thank you very much.